Why so glum?
She laid a hand on his arm, which tingled from the contact. They'd stopped at an empty place on the dock, down a ramp low to the water, and Commander Ironfist was drafting a Luxin platform onto the water, the first building block of a skull.
I don't know. Thinking about Tyria makes me think about...
And from somewhere that Kip didn't even know he had, tears tried to come up at the thought of his mother dying. He pushed them away, diverted them to someone more worth mourning.
You know, I hope your father's well, Liv. He was always good to me.
He was the only one. Yet even with Master Danavis, there had been a war, a point past which he wouldn't let Kip in. Was it just because of his own history that he had to keep secret? Or was there something deeper, something wrong with Kip?
Kip, Liv said, it's going to work out.
He looked over at her and couldn't help but smile. Orholm had never made a more beautiful woman. Liv could shame the sunset with her radiance. He fell into her dimples, hopeless. He looked away. Little brother, he sneered at himself. Fun to joke around with, but not a man. The despair threatened to choke him completely.
Thanks.
He managed to push past the lump in his throat. Can I have a snack? He asked Ironfist.
Yes, of course, the big man said.
Great.
When we get back.
Hey.
Now shut it. The Lord Prism is here.
All eyes still on him, Gavin stopped in front of Commander Ironfist. He looked at Ironfist's pack. Neither said anything for a long time.
You can't come. I'm not taking a bodyguard, Gavin said finally.
I'm not coming with you,
Ironfist said.
Then get off my skull.
I'm coming with Kip. He's a member of the Prism's family, and he's entitled to protection.
You're the commander of the Blackguard. You can't possibly...
I can do what I deem appropriate to discharge the duties of the Blackguard. None may interfere with that. None.
You are a wily bastard, aren't you? Gavin said.
It's why I'm still here,
Ironfist said.
And quite possibly why you are too.
Gavin grunted.
You win. But let me remind you of your oaths.
Ironfist looked offended.
You'll understand soon, Gavin said. Everyone load up.
With a quick, practiced hand, Gavin drafted a set of the special oars he used to propel the skull, but he clearly left room for Ironfist to draft his own, which he did, albeit much more slowly. Meanwhile, Gavin drafted a bench for Kip and Liv to sit on, and straps to hold all the bags in the boat. Ironfist wrinkled his nose at that, as if wondering why the bags would need to be strapped in, but he didn't ask. In moments, they were off. Gavin manned his oars and Ironfist manned his, and they sped out into the bay. The skull began veering to port almost immediately. It was Gavin's side. Kip realized Ironfist was rowing faster than Gavin, and the imbalance was driving them to port. Gavin looked over at Ironfist, who grinned back at him, continuing to sweep huge long strokes with his arms and legs. Gavin sped up. So did Ironfist. So did Gavin. Soon they were sculling across the water at a nice pace. Liv looked over at Kip.
Can you believe this? I've never gone this fast.
Kip laughed.
What?
She asked.
You'll see.
The men settled into a rhythm. They were going fast, competing, but neither trying to bury the other.
When are we going to meet your ship?
Ironfist asked, raising his voice to be heard over the wind.
We're going to cross the sea on this, Gavin said.
Ironfist laughed.
Right. You've got more endurance than I thought.
Kip grinned. The big Purian clearly didn't believe Gavin, but was willing to play along. After 20 minutes they were out of sight of any other ships. Barely slowing in his rowing, Gavin lifted one hand up and drafted one of the great tubes Kip had seen him use to propel the skimmer earlier. Ironfist looked at it quizzically.
This is what I meant about your oath, Gavin said. Secrecy.
A tube attached to another tube. Your secret is safe with me, O Prism,
Ironfist said, grinning.
I hope it gets us out of this port turn, though.
Gavin dropped the tube into the water. The deck shuddered as the first Luxin ball hit the water, streaming through the tube, then, as it quickly settled into the whop, whop, whoop that was familiar to Kip, the skimmer shot forward. The whole skimmer rose up, and Iron Fist almost fell over as his oars came free of the water. The skimmer sped up slowly and began to skip from one wave peak to the next. Then the skips got longer and longer, and soon the platform stopped hitting the waves at all. After a time, the astounded Iron Fist joined in, and they skimmed even faster. The water was so clear, Kip could see the tube cutting through the waves below them. Gavin had given each tube little wings. It was on those wings that the whole skimmer was flying above the surface. The wind was incredible, but Kip could hear Iron Fist whooping over it. Hours later, when the sun was halfway to the horizon, Gavin decided to switch back to sculling before they came in sight of Garriston. As the skimmer settled back on the waves, Iron Fist stepped away from his tube. His face was a writ of wonder, awe. He actually physically trembled. Then he swept into an elaborate bow before Gavin.
"My Lord Prism," he said, "you have made the world small."
Gavin bobbed his head, acknowledging the bow. "Small, maybe. Safe, no. Did you see a corvette over that way?" Iron Fist shook his head. Their watercraft, no longer lifted up by the action of the tubes, sat low in the water. But by the time Iron Fist had drafted new oars, a corvette appeared, a league away, ploughing right toward them. Iron Fist cursed. Gavin grinned recklessly. "So, Kip, Liv, you ever fought pirates?"
Chapter 56.
"Surely you're joking,"
Iron Fist said.
"My Lord Prism,"
he added, belatedly, and not enthusiastically.
"Let's go hunting," Gavin said.
"My Lord,"
Iron Fist said,
"I can't let you put yourself in that sort of danger. We can outrun these Elysian scum. They're not threatening our mission or us."
"Do you know what their summer is, Commander?" Gavin asked.
"I'm not sure what you're asking."
"It's time for the Rathgari handover of Garriston," Liv said, as if the words left a bad taste in her mouth.
"Do you know why she sounded so happy about that?" Gavin asked Iron Fist.
"I've never served on this side of the Cerulean Sea," Iron Fist said.
"I'm sure you know that each country that sided with me during the False Prism's War has rotating stewardship of Garriston."
"2 years or something for each country. So no one gets long-term designs on Tyria. Can we have this conversation at a safer distance?"
He glanced at the pirates. They were making good progress in the afternoon wind.
"That's what it was supposed to do," Gavin said. "Instead, each governor has taken it as a personal chance to get rich. The Pareans had the first rotation, and they stripped Garriston of everything that survived the fires. Every governor since then has followed their lead."
Liv spoke up. "During the first year, most governors try to keep the Umber River clear of bandits so the crops can get through. But most of the crops come in too late on the second year. The governors don't want to lose men killing bandits just to enrich the next governor from some other satrapy, so they withdraw into Garriston. Only the most optimistic farmers even bother planting on the second year anymore."
"While repeated sacking of Garriston and surrounding country is tragic, it doesn't have much to do with these pirates," Gavin said. "The handover happens after Midsummer's, 2 weeks from now. The Rathgari merchants and craftsmen and wives and whores are busily loading their ships to take whatever plunder they've managed to steal this time home, or just whatever they brought with them. I suppose just because every governor so far has been corrupt doesn't mean the smiths who shoe their horses are, too."
"This is fascinating," Iron Fist said. "But can't some long guns shoot 1800 or 1900 paces?"
"It's farther away than that," Gavin said. "Point is..."
"Finally, thank Orholom,"
Iron Fist muttered. "Ahem. Point is, there'll be an armada heading back to Rathgar in 2 weeks. The pirates descend like wolves and they take any ships that get separated from the main fleet."
"Serves them right," Liv said.
Gavin stared at her, and she scowled defiantly, but couldn't handle the eye contact, so she scowled at the waves. "Some merchants try to beat the rush and get out before the rest of the fleet, hoping they'll avoid the pirates."
"But here they are," Liv said.
"Exactly," Gavin said. "And if there's war this summer, especially, or Horlan forbid, if we lose, there'll be chaos. Dozens of ships, maybe hundreds, all going their own direction, fleeing.
A lot of the people in those ships will be Tyrian, Oliviana. Jill looked chastened.
Smoke, Kip said.
All conversation on the Little Skull stopped cold. Everyone turned to look. It would take an extremely skilled gunner to come within 100 paces of us at this distance, Gavin said. But Kip noticed he didn't take his eyes off the corvette either.
Maybe it was an empty charge, just to let us know.
The water erupted 20 paces in front of the skull. The sound of the shot reached them only afterward.
That was quite a shot, Gavin said. The good news is that very few corvettes have more than one gun mounted on the front, so we should have at least 30 seconds while that smoke, Kip said.
I hate this part, Gavin said. He and Iron Fist scrambled onto their oar apparatus. This time the splash was 50 paces in front of them.
Good to know the first one was lucky, Liv said.
Unless the second was unlucky, Kip said. Gavin looked at Iron Fist, a momentary worry line pressed between his eyes. Let's go.
Right.
They began rowing and quickly picked up speed.
What can I do?
Kip asked. He hated feeling useless.
Think,
Gavin said.
Think.
Kip looked at Liv to see if she had any idea what Gavin meant. She shrugged.
Smoke,
she said. Excruciating seconds passed, then Kip heard an odd whistling hum. The water exploded 50 paces behind them.
Didn't expect us to come straight at 'em, Gavin shouted. Next one'll be closer, he cackled.
The man had gone quite mad.
Smoke.
This time, Kip counted. 1, 2, 3, he strained his eyes. Surely he should be able to see something as big as a cannonball. 5, 6, boom! The water exploded not 15 paces to the left. Port of the skull. Kip actually felt spray.
See? Gavin said. Talented gunner!
Mad. Totally mad.
It's a 6 count between the smoke and the splash, Kip announced.
Good, Gavin shouted. Iron Fist, hard starboard as soon as they...
Smoke!
Liv said. The men cut hard to starboard, and the next shot splashed harmlessly a good distance away, albeit probably perilously close to where they would have been. Another shot, and they turned even more to starboard. Again, the shot was at least 30 paces off target. Kip looked at the wind and the sails of the Elysian ship. They were cutting at a hard angle, sails full, wind steady. It looked like a good platform to shoot from, but as for how Kip could use what he was seeing to help them survive, he had no idea. He just didn't know anything about sailing. They were getting closer, though. Now the lag between the smoke and the shot was less than 5 seconds. The skull cut back and forth, sometimes even stopping, and though Kip's fear never really shrank, he saw that Gavin was right. Their skull was simply too fast, too small, too maneuverable to get hit, unless the gunner made both a skillful and lucky shot. And though as they got closer to the Elysian ship, they had less time to move between the cannon being fired and the shot landing, the gunners were also having to change their angle more and more. There was a long pause between shots.
What's going on? Kip asked. Maybe they're tired of wasting powder?
Liv asked hopefully. 10 seconds later they had their answer as twin columns of smoke erupted from the cannons.
Port!
Gavin shouted. He'd guessed right. Water erupted both where they would have been if they'd gone straight, and where they would have been if they'd turned to starboard. Though it was longer between volleys, now the pirates could make 2 guesses of where the skull was headed instead of 1.
Clever bastard, Gavin said. Time to cheat. Kip, switch me.
He clambered off the oars and Kip jumped in.
Straight, Gavin said.
Blue flooded his skin and he drafted a propulsion tube into the water. As before, they leapt forward. Kip and Iron Fist almost fell as Gavin cut their oars smooth. But if he hadn't, Kip realized, they'd have been ripped apart by the inexorable turning of the gears. Gavin's teeth gritted under the strain of pushing the entire boat by himself, muscles knotting, veins standing out on his neck. But after a moment, as they gained speed and it became easier, he said,
Iron Fist, put 5 grenades in all the cannon holes and the sails. Liv, cut the rigging. Kip, you...
He paused, like he couldn't think of anything for Kip, the inept, to do.
You call out anything you think I don't see. Take my pistols.
Gavin pulled his hand from one of the tubes and drafted a basin and filled it with red Luxon in moments. Iron Fist instantly began drafting blue projectiles and filling them with a flammable goo. They traversed the last 500 paces before the men scrambling on deck could reload the front cannons. Only one man seemed unfazed by their impossible speed.
"Musketeer!"
Kip shouted. One of the gunners, whether or not it was their cannoneer with the preternatural aim Kip didn't know, stood at the bow, calmly tamping powder down his musket with a ramrod. With smooth, fast motions, he drew a square of cloth, reached into another pocket for a bullet, and then tamped those. He held a smoking slow match in his teeth. As they got closer, Kip saw that the gunner was Elishan, with skin as black as gunpowder, aboriginal features, a scattered dark beard, short loose trousers cut off below the knees, and an incongruously fine royal blue jacket over his lean frame with no shirt. His wiry black hair was bound in a thick ponytail. His knees were bent, compensating for the rolling motion of the deck as naturally as breathing. He fixed the burning fuse into place.
"I said, musketeer!"
Kip shouted. They cut the water right beside the corvette as the cannon portholes opened and the ship turned hard away from them. Gavin just turned with the bigger vessel. No one was going to do anything. Kip cocked the hammers of Gavin's dagger pistols, trying not to skewer himself on the long blades. The musketeer pivoted smoothly, aiming at Gavin. Kip raised both pistols. The musketeer shot first. His gun exploded in his hands, knocking him off his feet. Kip pulled both triggers. The pistol in his right hand scraped the flint against the frizzen but didn't throw a spark. Nothing happened. The pistol in his left hand roared. It kicked back at Kip with far more force than he'd expected. Kip spun, tripped, and slid toward the back of the skimmer, rolling, scrambling. He saw Liv flinging both of her hands forward, then turning, her pupils tiny pinpricks as she drafted Super Violet. Then she dove for him. Tumbling face down, Kip lost sight of Liv, the ship, the drafters, and the battle. All he saw was the slick blue of the skimmer's deck sliding away below him. His face slid over the edge, his forehead skipped off the water, blurring past them, making his whole head bounce up, just about tearing his head off his neck. On the second bounce he wasn't so lucky. His nose went under, and positioned off the back of the skimmer as he was, his nostrils acted as twin scoops, jetting water up into his sinuses at great speed. Liv must have grabbed him because there was no third bounce, but Kip could see nothing, think of nothing. He was coughing, retching, crying, blind, spitting up salt water. By the time he propped himself up, the Elishan corvette was 200 paces behind them. Its sails sagged, cut and burning. Smoke billowed out of all the cannon portholes on the starboard side, and fire was visible on the decks. And the whole ship was sitting low in the water. Men were leaping off the decks on every side. Commander Ironfist, who'd barely said two words the entire time, said,
"Men jumping off that fast means the fire must be headed for the
middle of the corvette exploded, sending wood and ropes and barrels and men flying every direction.
"Powder magazine," Iron Fist finished. "Sorry, bastards."
"Men like those kill and rape and steal and enslave, they don't deserve our pity," Gavin said, slowing the skimmer. He was talking to Liv and Kip, who both sat almost equally wide-eyed. "But Iron Fist's right. It's no easy thing to be the hand of justice." He dropped the tube into the water. "We'll row the rest of the way. By the by, nice shot, Kip."
"I hit him?"
"Blew the captain right off his wheel."
"The wheel's at the, back, right?"
The musketeer had been at the front.
"Stern?"
Liv suggested. A dubious look. "You weren't aiming at the captain, were you?" Gavin asked.
"Aiming?"
Kip asked, grinning.
"Or Hollum have mercy, the nut doesn't fall far from the tree,"
Ironfist said.
"However, luck is not dropping your father's priceless one-of-a-kind pistols in the sea," Gavin said.
"I dropped your pistols?"
Kip asked, heart dropping.
"Whereas Slick is catching said pistols at the last moment," Gavin said, producing the weapons from behind his back. He grinned.
"Oh, thank old Hollum," Kip breathed.
"You've still almost lost my pistols," Gavin said. "And for that, you get to row. Liv, you too."
"What?"
"You're his tutor. He's your responsibility. Everything he does wrong is on you."
Oh, perfect, she said.
Chapter 57
It looks so dirty, Kip said.
After seeing the wealth of Big Jasper and the magical edifices of the Chromeria, Garriston looked decidedly unimpressive.
Dirt is the least of it, Gavin said.
Kip wasn't sure what that meant, but he was sorry that he'd been unconscious when he'd floated through the city the first time with Gavin. If he had seen Garriston then, it would have doubtless been impressive. It would have been the largest gathering of humanity he'd seen in his life, at least, if not the cleanest. Rectan's Alcaldessa would never have tolerated the heaps of trash Kip could see pushed into the alleys just off the docks, sitting right next to crates often holding food. Disgusting. The docks had perhaps 40 ships, half protected by a seawall with great gaps in it. Liv saw Kip looking at the holes, wondering if there was some purpose for them.
The occupiers never really want to break their backs helping out us backward Tyrians, she said. The moorages opposite the gaps in the seawall are given to locals. You should see the captain scurry when a winter storm comes. The soldiers gather up in the towers and take bets on whether individual ships will break up.
The Skull, powered by Liv and a hard-breathing Kip, cruised past galleys, galleasses, corvettes, and fishing dories full of locals mending their nets. The men and women stopped their work at the sight of a skull, much less a skull with such an exotic crew. It warmed Kip just to see Tyrian faces again. It made him feel at home. Only as they went past did he see the hostility on those faces. Ah, not much for foreign drafters. Guess that makes sense.
Where are we going? Kip asked.
Commander Ironfist pointed to the most magnificent, tallest building in the city. From here, all Kip could see was the perfect egg-shaped tower with a spike pointing to heaven. A wide stripe around the widest part of the tower was inlaid with tiny round mirrors, none bigger than Kip's thumb. In the afternoon sun, the tower seemed to be on fire. Above and below that stripe of mirrors, similar stripes of other colours of glass were inlaid as well.
I sort of figured, Kip said. What I meant was, where should we dock the skull?
Right there, Gavin said, pointing to a blank wall at the point nearest the gate. It wasn't a docking spot, and the level of the streets was a good 4 paces above the level of the water. Nonetheless, Kip and Liv steered, fairly expertly, Kip thought, toward the wall. The skull's nose dipped lower in the water as blue Luxin bloomed on the front of the boat and snaked out. It solidified as soon as it touched the wall and became steps, locking the skull in place and giving them easy egress.
I'm still not used to this whole magic thing, Kip said.
I'm 38 years old, Commander Ironfist said, and I'm not used to it. Just a little quicker to react. Grab your packs.
They did, and climbed the stairs to street level while locals looked at them curiously. After they were all off, Gavin touched a corner of the stairs. All the Luxin in the skull lost coherence and dissolved, falling into the water as dust, grit, and goo, depending on its colour. The yellow even flashed a little. Much of its mass translated back into light, and the water popped up a little, suddenly freed of the weight of the skull. Gavin, of course, paid it all no heed.
This is normal for him. What kind of world have I stepped into?
If Gavin were at dinner and misplaced his knife, he'd draft one rather than get up and look. If his cup were dirty, he'd draft a new one rather than clean the old. That gave Kip a thought.
Gavin, Lord Prism, why don't drafters wear Luxin? Kip asked.
Gavin grinned. They do, sometimes. Obviously, yellow breastplates and such are highly valued in battle, but I'm guessing you mean as clothes.
You use magic for everything, Kip said.
That's me, Gavin said. A normal drafter isn't going to shorten her life just so she doesn't have to dock her skull another 50 paces out. Well, some would, of course. The truth is, there was a fashion of wearing Luxin clothing once, when I was a boy. With the application of enough will, even some kinds of sealed Luxin can become fairly flexible. Soon there were drafter tailors who specialized in the clothing, but most people couldn't afford them. And if you make your own, there are any number of mistakes you can make. Some are fairly harmless, like making your pant legs too stiff. But if you made a mistake in the drafting, your shirt might dissolve into dust in the middle of a day. Or, Gavin cleared his throat, certain
mischievous boys might learn how to unseal the Luxon that the tailor drafters had woven. These boys might have caused some chaos at a memorable party, where the ladies who'd gone to the expense of even having Luxon undergarments found themselves in particular distress. His mouth tightened, hiding a grin at a memory. Sadly, the fashion ended rather abruptly after that.
"That was you.
I heard about that party," Liv said. "I'm sure whatever you heard was much exaggerated," Gavin said.
"No," Ironfist said. "It wasn't."
Gavin shrugged. "I was a bad child. Fortunately, I've come a long way since then. Now I'm a bad man." He smiled, but it didn't touch his eyes. "Here we go," he said as three Hrothgari men approached. The three all wore what looked to Kip like wool sheets with a hole cut for the head, carefully folded so there were pleats at their wide leather belts. The garment, a tunic, then fell to the men's knees. Though their legs were bare, the wool seemed entirely inappropriate for Tyria's climate, and all three were sweating freely. All wore leather sandals, though the guards laced up into shin armor. The guards each carried a pilum, and a gladius, and a crude pistol at their belts. The man in the lead, apparently in charge, had his tunic embroidered at the hem and on each breast. He carried a scroll, a large bag, slung over one shoulder, and a heavy purse at his belt. He wore a pair of clear spectacles, low on his nose. Clear spectacles? What kind of drafter would want clear spectacles? But as the men came close, Kip realized the man wasn't a drafter at all. His eyes were clear brown. The men were also all pale, a common Hrothgari trait, Kip guessed. With their skin barely bronzed, they weren't pale or freckled like blood foresters, but they still seemed pretty ghostly. Their hair was a normal dark hue from brown to black, but straight and fine. They walked with either authority or hauteur. Kip glanced at Liv. She was definitely taking their attitude as the latter. She practically sneered at them. Kip thought she might spit at their feet.
"I am the assistant portmaster," the man said. "Where's your vessel? The tax is levied according to size and term of stay."
"I'm afraid the size of our vessel is negligible at the moment," Gavin said.
"I'll be the judge of that, thank you.
Where do you dock?"
"Right about there," Gavin said, pointing.
The assistant portmaster looked, then glanced up and down the wall, squinting. There were no ships within 50 paces. He folded his arms, his jaw setting as if Gavin were making fun of him.
"The tax isn't heavy, but let me assure you, the penalty for attempting to evade taxation is."
One of the guards tapped the assistant portmaster's shoulder, but the man ignored him. "As it should be," Gavin said, still polite. He handed over a letter. The man held the letter low, so he was looking through his spectacles, like he was going to draft the letters right into words.
"Oh," he said quietly.
"Oh. Oh." The man's head snapped up, and he peered at Gavin's eyes through his spectacles.
"Oh, my lord, Prism, 1,000 pardons. Please, my lord, let us accompany you to the fortress. It would be a great honour to us."
Gavin inclined his head. "I sort of thought you'd pick them all up with magic and shake them or something," Kip said, once they all fell in behind the guards and the assistant portmaster.
"There's a time to toss idiots around," Gavin said. "But this man's just doing his job."
They walked into the shadow of the fortress, whose northern wall nearly overhung the harbour. Both of them looked up. There were archers walking along the top of the wall, looking down at them.
"Besides," Gavin said, "you start throwing Luxon around, you never know who's going to answer with gunfire."
The assistant talked to the men guarding the gate. Lots of furtive glances at Gavin followed. Kip was busy looking at the fortress. The gate and the entire fortress was carved travertine, mellow green incised with a cross-hatched pattern to make the stone look woven rather than carved. There were a number of murder holes cut in the gate. As the soldiers opened the gate, Kip saw that it led to a short killing ground, entirely enclosed, with murder holes everywhere. Then another gate. The guards at the second gate, which was open, carried muskets with almost bell-shaped muzzles. These guns were also shorter than the muskets the guards at the Chromeria carried. Kip was next to Ironfist now, so he asked, "Why are their muskets so short?"
"Blunderbusses," Ironfist said. "Instead of a ball, they load them with cobbler's nails or chain. At short range, you can hit 4 or 5 men. or blow a good hole in one. Good for rioters. A man cut in half isn't any less dead than one with a small hole in his heart, but he's a much greater deterrent to everyone else in the crowd.
Nice, Kip said, swallowing.
After a few more checkpoints, at which they accrued a few more senior guards, they climbed several floors. When they were on the third floor, they passed an open door to chambers overlooking the sea. Gavin stopped abruptly. Their escorts didn't notice immediately. Ignoring them, Gavin walked into the room. Iron Fist, Kip, and Liv followed him. The room was a suite of apartments filled with paintings, pillows, screens with ornate paintings of hunts, fireplaces, several chandeliers, and great long-handled fans for room slaves to waft their masters. Everywhere Kip looked, things sparkled, shined, and gleamed.
"This," Gavin announced as his escorts hurried in, "will be sufficient."
"Yes, Lord Prism, of course, this is the guest of honor's suite we'll get
for my servants," Gavin finished. "Kip, Liv, I trust you can stay out of trouble while I get our accommodations arranged."
"Yes, of course, my Lord Prism," Liv said,
a formality and maturity in her voice that Kip wasn't familiar with.
"Start Kip's drafting lessons. I'll check up on you after I'm finished with a few things."
"Of course,"
Liv said, curtsying.
Kip half bowed and instantly felt deeply foolish. He didn't know how to bow. No one bowed where he grew up.
"Iron Fist," Gavin said.
Iron Fist raised an eyebrow. "Oh, now you want me to go with you?"
"Best chance you'll have to see a pompous Hrothgari governor get kicked out of his rooms. More if you're lucky. Might even be someone you know." The corner of Iron Fist's mouth twitched.
"It's the simple pleasures that make life beautiful, isn't it?"
Chapter 58. The door closed behind them, and abruptly Kip and Liv were alone, away from the important people and the matters of state. Children, once more.
Liv looked at Kip for a long time.
"What?" Kip asked. "Sometimes it's really strange to me that you are who you are. A week ago I would have blushed just at seeing Commander Iron Fist. Now I'm sitting in the finest rooms in the Travertine Palace, and they're mine?"
"I've given up trying to understand it all," Kip said.
"I think if I stop and think too much, I'll become a blubbering baby. Things will just fall apart."
In a moment Liv's face changed. Her eyes softened, compassion etched on every feature.
"You were there, in the village, when it happened.
At Greenbridge, with Issa and Sanson, and Ram, of course."
He still wanted to sneer at the very thought of Ram, but that seemed cruel and small now.
"Ram and Issa were killed. Sanson and I got away, but eventually they killed him, too."
Kip's voice was wooden and distant, even in his own ears. He couldn't even look at Liv. If he saw her compassion, he'd break. He already looked weak and foolish and young and fat in her eyes, a boy to be pitied. He didn't need to make it worse by crying.
"My mother made it out, but her skull was smashed. I was with her when she—"
"Oh, Kip, I'm so sorry."
He pushed that down, pushed it aside.
"Anyway, I really do hope your father got out. He was always good to me. In fact, if he hadn't made me leave when he did, I'd be dead."
Liv said nothing for a time. Kip couldn't decide if it was an awkward silence or not.
"Kip,"
she said finally,
"I've been trying to work up the nerve to— things can be really complicated now. With who your father is and the way things are at the Chromaria, sometimes things don't really go the way we want. And we—"
"Am I supposed to have some idea what you're talking about?"
Kip asked.
"'Cause—"
She opened her mouth and looked at him again. Then he saw the gates come down.
"I'm just really glad you made it out, Kip."
"Thanks," he said.
"Thanks for not trusting me enough to say whatever you just wanted to say."
"Should we get started?"
She smiled wanly, like she wanted to say more but didn't know how.
"Sure. Come out to the balcony."
They walked out onto the balcony, which hung literally over the sea. From above, they could hear the muffled voices of men speaking on top of the Travertine Palace. Kip stood looking out at the sea, trying to put himself in a frame of mind to concentrate, and said,
"What do I do?"
"To draft, you need four things," Liv said. "Skill, will,
Sauce and still, Kip said. Sorry, I have picked up a thing or two.
Right. So there's basically modifications and nuances to each of the big four, but that's where it all starts. Let's start with sauce.
Kip thought that he'd picked up a lot of what she was going to say, but one doesn't interrupt a beautiful girl unless one is going to be funny. Liv rummaged through her pack and pulled out a rolled-up green cloth, and then a white one.
We'll hold off on the color theory as much as we can, she said. We know you've drafted green, so your source can either be something reflecting green light in the world, or you can take something that has green as a component color and look at it through a lens.
Huh? Kip said. So much for this all being a repeat. What do you mean, reflecting green? You mean something green?
Something you'll learn the further you go in the Chromeria is that your experience of a thing and the nature of the thing itself are often different things.
Sounds, metaphysical, Kip said. Hadn't Gavin said something like that?
Some take it that way, too, but I'm speaking strictly physically. Look at this.
Liv pulled out another cloth. It was a red spectrum, but instead of flowing smoothly from the deepest to the lightest red, there were parts that took steps back.
When you look at this, Kip, you can tell that it's off. It generally goes right, but there are sub-colors out of sequence. Most men can't see that. They think it's right. They can differentiate these four spectral blocks here, but not these blocks inside. It doesn't matter how hard they try or how long they study it. Their experience of it is less nuanced than yours or mine. Now, quite honestly, we don't know if what you and I see is the totality of what is actually there, or if some people from beyond the Great Desert might think we're as blind as we think the men are who can't tell this from this.
That's weird.
I know. In class, the magisters usually have every boy come to the front and attempt the test, just because so many of the girls who can see the differences can't believe that everyone else can't see them too. It's pretty humiliating.
Actually, I think it's worse for the girls who can't see it either. The boys aren't expected to pass. The girls who can't see it feel awful.
She shook herself. Tangent. The point to remember, even if you don't believe it now, is that color doesn't inhere in a thing. Things reflect or absorb colors from light. You think this cloth is green. It's not. Really, it's a cloth that absorbs all colors, except green.
This is us saving color theory for later? Kip asked lightly. She paused. Then she saw he was teasing and she smiled.
No, you don't. I'm not going to get drawn into more tangents. The point is, light is primary. This cloth in a dark room is worthless to you. Obviously, you can take the religious significances pretty deep, but you and I are only going to talk about the physical, not the metaphysical. You can draft green light. There are only a couple of ways for you to do that. The best is to have green things around you, especially if you have lots of them, especially if you have lots of different hues and tones available.
So, like a forest.
Exactly. That's why before the unification, the green goddess Atarat was worshipped in Hrothgar and the Blood Forest more than anywhere else. Green drafters flocked to the forests and the verdant plains because they were more powerful there than anywhere else. In turn, those lands were dominated by the green virtues and the green vices, either simply because of the sheer amount of green being drafted there or because Atarat was real. Take your pick.
That I don't understand.
We'll worry about all that later. The second best way to draft is to have spectacles like these.
She reached into her pack and pulled out a little cotton pouch. Loosening the drawstring, she withdrew a pair of green spectacles.
You don't draft green, Kip said.
No, I don't,
Liv said, smiling.
They're for me?
Kip asked. Tingles shot down his spine. Liv smiled broadly.
Usually there's a little ceremony, but it amounts to a congratulations.
Kip took the spectacles gingerly. They had perfectly round lenses set in a thin iron frame. He put them on his face. Liv stepped close and measured where the arms of the spectacles passed over his ears. Kip could smell her. Somehow, after a full day skimming across the entire sea and fighting pirates and then baking in the sun, she smelled wonderful. Of course, Kip hadn't been this close to a woman very often, except his mother, usually covered with sweat or vomit, on the night he was unlucky and had to carry her home. Issa had smelled good, too,
but different than Liv.
Issa had barely crossed Kip's mind in the last days. He'd thought about her, but there was something hollow there.
He'd let himself daydream about kissing Issa someday, but maybe that had been more because she was there than that she was perfect for him. Or because she was there and Liv wasn't, and Kip needed something to distract him from thinking about Liv. And now here she was. She'd measured both sides, and she took his spectacles off and was carefully bending the arms to fit behind his ears.
"Hmm," she said. "Your right ear's higher than the left."
"My ears are lopsided," Kip said, as if I didn't have enough to be self-conscious about.
"Don't worry, mine are too. Really, most people's are off a little bit."
She paused.
"Just not quite so much."
She shook her head in disbelief.
"I've got freakish ears."
Liv grinned wickedly.
"Gotcha." "Or Holland's
beard," Kip scowled. "Every time. Every stinkin' time." She smiled, self-satisfied, and gave the nose pieces a final bend, then propped the spectacles on his face.
"There. You might have to play with them to make them more comfortable, but they aren't really meant to be on your face all day long anyway."
He looked around and was not terribly surprised to see that most everything had a greenish tinge through the green glass.
"What you're seeing is white light from the sun reflected off of surfaces, then filtered through your lenses. So if you're surrounded by white marble walls or something, you'll be able to draft almost as much as if you were in a forest. The lenses aren't as good as drafting from natural greens, but it's better than nothing. You can't just look at anything, though. Look around. You see how some things really look green and others don't? Like if you look at this cloth, what color does it appear to be?"
She drew another cloth out of her bag.
Red,
Kip thought. He could hear Gavin's voice from the floor above them, getting louder, angry.
"It is red."
Refocusing his attention on Liv, Kip looked over his glasses, and though the cloth's tone was changed a little, it was indeed red.
"So how does that work?" he asked.
"The spectacles will only help if there are surfaces that are reflecting green to you. White surfaces work best because white is all the colors together. Much less good, but sometimes possible, will be drafting through your lenses when looking at yellow or blue surfaces, since green is a secondary color."
"Lost me there."
"So now you want the color theory?" she grinned, joking.
"For your purposes, if you need to draft, the spectacles will help most if you can find things that are either white or light-colored. Ripe wheat would work, a spruce tree won't," Liv said.
"I think I can remember that," Kip said. The whole things aren't the color they are thing really didn't make sense, but he suspected he could wrestle with that later.
"Good, so that covers source, for the time being."
"You mean we still have to cover skill, will, and still?"
Liv said, "I don't want to beat this to death, and I'm sorry you don't get to have the ceremony, because maybe that helps this sink in. Those spectacles are now your most important possession. Not only do most drafters have to save up for months, or even a year to afford one pair of spectacles, but everyone then immediately saves for a spare pair. If you get rich, or if the Prism orders it, I suppose, you can have a custom pair made by the lens grinders. They can give you a darker or lighter green, or adjust the frame for fit or looks. But without your spectacles, you're close to powerless. I know you've been with the Prism, but he's the exception. He doesn't need spectacles. His eyes don't halo. He can use as much magic as he wants. The rules don't apply to him. Even the rules for Prisms don't seem to apply to him. Can you imagine anyone else coming in here alone and simply taking over? From the Hrothgari? And the funny thing is, they're going to take it. They won't like it, but they'll—"
A man's voice from the roof interrupted her.
"I don't give a good god's damn what your paper says. There's no way you're—"
The man cut off with a yelp. Kip looked up just as the man plunged past their balcony. He landed far below with a huge splash in the bay, and Kip saw him struggle to the surface, spluttering, his rich clothes billowing in the water. He started crying for help.
"This is outrage!"
someone started to shout, then Kip saw another man plunge past the balcony. He splashed in the bay, almost on top of the governor. There was a gigantic burst of light.
"So help me, the next one of you isn't going to land in water,"
Gavin said, his voice ringing. Kip expected to hear gunshots. Surely the governor had guards. But there was nothing. They took it. "That's my father."
"That's my father?"
Gavin imposed his will, and the world took it.
"So,"
Kip said,
feeling very much like the men floundering in the bay beneath him, barely able to swim and desperate to be pulled out. So, Will, that's next, right?
Chapter 59 Corvin Danevis approached Garriston as the sun set. The outer walls of Garriston, of course, had long ago been demolished. During the Prism's War, Corvin never thought of it as the false Prism's War, he had set men to working on rebuilding them, but there just hadn't been time. The outer wall had been built to shield a city of hundreds of thousands. At the time of the war, there had been perhaps 90,000. There had been no way to protect them all. The irrigation canals that could have been watering all the land between the outer walls and the inner walls were broken, except for one or two, but the inner walls still stood, as did the ladies. The ladies, mostly now stripped of associations with the goddess Anat, guarded each gate. Each was an enormous white statue incorporated into the wall itself. Each had represented an aspect of Anat. The guardian was the colossus standing astride the entrance to the bay. The mother guarded the south gate, heavily pregnant, defiant, dagger-bared. The hag guarded the west gate, leaning heavily on a staff. The lover lay across the river gate to the east. For reasons Corvin had never understood, the lover was depicted perhaps in her 30s, while the mother was depicted as very young, perhaps still in her teens. Each was carved of the most expensive, faintly translucent white marble, such as was only available in Perea. Orholm alone knew how they'd shipped so much this far. The statues, luckily, had been coated in the finest sealed yellow luxin, all of one piece. Astounding work. The city had been invaded at least 3 times, and still the ladies were unmarked, even after the fiery devastation of the great conflagration. Anat, the Lady of the Desert, the fiery mistress, the sub-red, had been the goddess of all hot passions, wrath, protection, vengeance, possessive love, and furious love-making. When Lucidonius had taken the city for Orholm and eliminated the cult, his followers had wanted to tear down the statues, which, granted, would have taken some powerful drafters. Famously, Lucidonius had stopped them, saying, "Tear down only what is false." Several times in the intervening centuries, zealous Prisms had wanted to tear down the pagan relics anyway, but each time the city had threatened war. Until the Prisms' War, Garriston had had enough military power that a threat of going to war with her was daunting. Corvin had never approached the lover at sunset. As with the other ladies, her body was incorporated into the gate. She lay on her back, back arched over the river, feet planted, her knees forming a tower on one bank, hands entwined in her hair, elbows rising to form the tower on the other bank. She was clad only in veils, and before the war, a portcullis could be lowered from her arched body into the river, its iron and steel hammered into shape so that they looked like a continuation of her veils. But in the war, the portcullis had been broken and never replaced. The sight of her still took Corvin's breath. With the sun setting, the thin yellow luxin sealing the statue, usually nearly invisible, was set alight. The yellow was like golden bronze skin, fading slowly as Corvin walked, and the sun sank, finally leaving only a welcoming silhouette, a wife waiting abed for her long-absent husband. It sent a pang through him. He could never come here without thinking of Cora, his first wife, Liv's mother. Cora had greeted him like that once, lying abed, clad only in veils, deliberately mimicking the lover when Corvin had returned to her. Even now, 18 years later, grief and remembered desire and joy and love twined in his breast. Corvin had remarried in Recton, 2 years after Cora's death, but marrying El had been more to give Liv a mother than for love. 3 years later, El had been murdered by an assassin who'd finally tracked Corvin down. Corvin had considered moving, but the Alcaldessa begged him to stay, and Kip was there. So he'd stayed. But he'd not remarried again. Not even with the overwhelming number of women for every man in Recton and the constant carping of the would-be matchmakers. He couldn't love as he had loved before. Losing another woman he loved as much as he'd loved Cora would kill him.
and it wasn't fair to ask another woman to act as mother to his daughter if he wasn't willing to love her with his whole heart. Corvin no longer had a whole heart to give. He trudged on, past farms with their thin but ripening crops of spelt and barley, trying not to look at the lover stretched luxuriously before him. Reaching the gate, which opened through the spilling tresses of her hair, he joined the line of men and women heading back into the city, brushing past those heading back out for the night. He kept his eyes down as he passed between two Hrothgari guards, who had still been on their mother's knees during the war. They were barely paying any attention to the stream of people passing by them, however. One was leaning against the lover's cascading hair, his foot propped against the rippling stone, his straw petasos, the characteristic Hrothgari broad-brimmed hat, thrown back to hang from his neck now that the sun wasn't beating down on them.
"Think he's here for?"
he was asking.
"Scorch me, if I know. But they say he threw Governor Crassus into the bay. I suppose we'll—"
Corvin couldn't hear any more without pausing, and pausing meant inviting attention. Inviting attention might mean making eye contact. And with Corvin's red-haloed eyes, that wasn't a good idea. So someone powerful had come to Garriston. But who was powerful enough to throw a governor in the bay? Corvin didn't know anything about this Governor Crassus, but the Hrothgari royal family had half a dozen young princes. Most likely one of them had been sent to help oversee the withdrawal from Garriston. No one else would dare throw a Hrothgari governor into the sea. An impulsive prince actually might be better for Corvin's purposes than a comfortable governor. Harder to deal with at first, but more likely to prepare for war, and war was what Corvin was bringing, like it or not. As he passed through the city, he found himself analyzing it like the general he used to be. King Haradul might be a monster, but the Hrothgari were the occupiers. Who would the people of Garriston join? And would they join enthusiastically or not? As Corvin walked, he paid particular attention to the Hrothgari soldiers. At times the men walked singly, running errands for their commanders, or simply heading back to barracks or out to taverns. He saw a soldier get jostled on accident by a vendor closing his carpet stall, who backed up too quickly. The soldier pushed past like it was an annoyance, but never checked his back. The vendor, a native Tyrian, apologized respectfully but without fear. This wasn't a city on the verge of revolt. The Tyrians had grown accustomed to being occupied. The Hrothgari were the fourth satrapy to do so, and this was their second time around. Not every nation got a turn in the occupation and spoils. Perea had had the first 2 years, and if they'd had the richest spoils to steal, they'd also had the task of putting down the most rebels. But the Illyrians had ostensibly fought on Dazen's side and had no central government anyway, so they didn't get a turn. The Arbornians had preferred to trade with both sides and had entered the fight only after the Battle of Sundered Rock. They didn't get a turn either. That left the Pereans, the Atashians, the Blood Foresters, and the Hrothgari. In that order, if Corvin remembered correctly. It made sense that the people of Garriston would have their favourites, or at least those less hated, among their occupiers. It took Corvin only a bit of mental shuttling to figure that, with the Pereans replacing the Hrothgari, this would be the third time Garriston had endured the Pereans. The most easily tolerated occupiers were about to be replaced by the most hated ones. But the question his observations didn't answer was just how much fear was mixed with the hatred of the Pereans. The Pereans had put down rebels both times they'd ruled. Maybe their cruelty meant the Tyrians would think twice before taking up weapons. It might mean they would take them up more quickly. Corvin didn't know. Couldn't know without spending a lot of time in the city. Time he didn't have. The city was more cosmopolitan than it had been the last time he had visited, some 10 years ago. Before the war, Garriston had been as populous and diverse as any rich port city in the world. After the war, everyone who could leave had left, especially those who looked like they were from elsewhere. Tensions had run high. During that time, the only people in Garriston were native Tyrians and their occupiers of the moment. Apparently, with each round of occupation, a few traders and soldiers had stayed and intermarried with locals. Corvin saw two shopkeepers chatting as they swept out their open stalls with straw brooms. One woman had the traditional Tyrian caramel skin and dark, full brows and wavy hair, while the woman next to her had skin like honey and ash-blonde hair, rare even for the Hrothgari. They were dressed almost identically, bangles on their wrists, long flax skirts, hair tied back with scarves. Corvin passed an alley where children played gada together, kicking and passing a ball of wrapped leather. There were more obviously Tyrian-blooded children than any other kind, but the teams were mixed. A few mothers had gathered to watch, and they stood close to each other, regardless of what Corvin would have guessed were their origins, gossiping or shouting encouragement. Not a powder keg. That was good. A radical shift in power and lawlessness in a city where neighbor hated neighbor would have invited wanton bloodshed. Garriston had seen enough of that. The water market, basically an outside version of what Recton had, was nearly empty, except for a few food vendors offering quick meals to passing soldiers and those who had otherwise missed dinner. Corvin bought a few skewers of rabbit and fish, marinated in a fiery Elysian pepper sauce, and kept walking. Before he headed to the Travertine Palace, Corvin walked to the Hag's Gate. Here, like the Guardian's Gate and the Lover's Gate, the statue was worked into the wall, but this time Corvin had no interest in the statue. He had come to watch the soldiers. The gates had closed for the night, though it had doubtless been a long time since raiders had dared move against the city itself. The soldiers who stood at the top of the wall were joking, laughing, talking loudly, even drinking when their superiors left. Corvin had seen arches atop the Hag's Crown and at the top of the Hag's Staff, the two towers on either side of the gate, but after the two women settled in, quivers laid down, bows unstrung, they never made a circuit of their respective posts. So, soldiers with little discipline. Soldiers who had become city guards through no fault of their own. In the first year of an occupation, the soldiers might be sent against raiders and brigands or patrol the river's length. After that, they retreated to the city and became guards. The soldierly duties came to seem extraneous, and discipline slipped. Sitting watch in towers where there was never anything to watch for soon became a post where soldiers gambled and drank. Corvin headed toward the Travertine Palace. Of course, there was no way they were going to let some peasant walk in off the street and meet their prince, so when he got close to the front gate, he ducked into an alley. After Carys had been captured, Corvin had scouted King Haradul's camp enough to decide that any attempt at rescue would be suicide. Then, as they'd rendezvoused with other generals swelling the army, most likely with forced levies, they'd turned south. Corvin had headed back to a cave outside of Recton. He was almost disappointed that thieves had never found his cache. When Recton's Alcaldessa had told Corvin that he and his daughter could stay, he'd hidden away everything that could connect him to the war, both for his new home's sake and his own. He'd shaved off his distinctive beaded mustache and traded rich clothes and weapons for flaxen pants and a dyer's shop. What had seemed meager gold in his pockets then was now a fortune in his eyes, but in the intervening years it had all been unspendable. No one in Recton had gold coins, especially not stamped with a blood forester's satrap's face. So now he pulled out the long-folded Samite tunic, swept off a portion of the ground with his hand, and laid it on it. Next came a broad leather belt, embossed with crocodiles, with tiny ruby eyes in emerald-dotted swamps, with diamond-eyed herons. Last he drew out Harbinger, the sword that had passed to him only when the last of his elder brothers died. A young boy sat on the curb opposite him, silently watching, quizzical. Corvin tried to ignore him. He stripped off his long shirt and pulled out a mirror. With mirror and a skin of water, he did his best to clean himself up. Then he dried himself with a dirty shirt and pulled on his rich clothes. There was nothing to be done about his boots or pants, but the Samite tunic and the stress was going to have him sweating enough as it was. After packing his things and strapping Harbinger onto his belt and pushing his hair into something resembling order, he took a deep breath and rounded the corner, approaching the gate.
"I need to see whoever's in charge," Corvin said to the guards, walking like a man with purpose.
One of the guards said, looking confused and glancing at the other guard. Apparently they didn't know if he meant the governor or the prince.
"Whoever threw the governor in the bay," Corvin said, "it's an emergency."
The guards shared a look.
"Got no reason not to waste his time," one guard said to the other. "He's not exactly given us cause to screen his visitors carefully."
The other Athgari soldier grinned.
"We'll take you right to him, sir."
They didn't even ask his name. Corvin followed them, astounded by his good fortune.
Apparently the prince, presumably a younger prince, or the Hrothgari wouldn't dare behave this way, hadn't been endearing himself to the common soldiers. Even more incredibly, the soldier marched him straight to the council room. Corvin hadn't been there in 16 years. The man rapped a quick code on the door, and the guards inside opened it. He whispered something about emergency, looks important, to the guard, and then beat a hasty retreat. The council room guard, a tall, serious Hrothgari, ushered Corvin in.
"Name?"
he asked quietly. Corvin stepped inside. The Hrothgari prince was leaning over a table in the council room, his back to Corvin.
"Corvin Danavis,"
Corvin said quietly. There was a huge, both tall and thickly muscled, ebony guard standing across from the prince, his eyes hard, studying Corvin, taking note of the sword at his side. He wore all black. This prince had some nerve, pretending to have his own black guard. When the Chromeria found out about that, it would not be pleased.
"Corvin Danavis," the guard announced loudly. "He says he has an emergency message, my Lord Prism."
It was like lightning hit all three men at once. The blackguard, an actual, real blackguard, for Holland's sake, had two pistols out and his blue spectacles on half a breath after Corvin's name was announced. The Prism, not a princeling, Gavin Gyle himself, stood and turned.